Now it's time for me to introduce our speaker. I had the good fortune of running into David Walker at the LDS Church History Library about a year ago, and he was doing some mop-up research on his forthcoming book, and it just seemed to fit so naturally with our theme and our plans for this conference that it was just really an honor for me to invite him to come in and share with us his scholarship. Typically, our opening plenary session sort of sets the stage for the place. Didn't think we needed an introduction to Salt Lake City, so really happy to have David Walker share with us sort of his research, which dovetails so nicely with our conference theme and sort of commemorating the 150th anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, but also what that meant for Mormons and religion more generally. So let me introduce David Walker to you. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He received his PhD in religious studies at Yale University. His work focuses on intersections of religion, industry, and tourist economies in the 19th century American West. Recent publications treat ritual innovations in spiritualism and stage magic, and railroad companies' influence on popular understandings of Mormonism. His book, Railroading Religion, Mormons, Tourists, and the Corporate Spirit of the West, is forthcoming fall of 2019 from the University of North Carolina Press. So get in your orders now. His talk today is titled Mormons and Other Western Wonders, Tourist Interest in the Railroad Age. Please join with me in welcoming David Walker.
Thank you for those kind words of welcome. And to offer another few such words of welcome, or rather acknowledgement, I want to acknowledge that we're gathered on some of the traditional homelands of the Numic peoples in the border regions between Shoshone and Ute lands in particular. I want to acknowledge with and among you all these people's past and continuing connections to this region. And I want to give thanks also for the opportunity to live and work and learn on such significant lands ourselves in the mixed company that is gathered today. And by way of transition to my talk, I want to also note that visitors to these lands in the early railroad era, some 150 years ago to the season, I note that railroad visitors seldom read any such acknowledgement in their tourism guidebooks. Nor did they hear as much from their tourism guides. Indigenous people were continually written out of the histories of these lands, especially histories written in and for the transcontinental era. Now, this will likely not come as a surprise to us in this room. We're familiar with the colonial presumptions of 19th century railroad builders and railroad riders alike, and indeed with the ubiquitous idea that railroads would displace native peoples and facilitate the kind of settlement and industry and governmental oversight that would, people said, solve the, quote, Indian problem, quote, for good. Of course, all such phrases should be put in scare quotes. Now, as I've said, all of this should not be especially surprising to us, even as we've come to recognize it for what it is: awful, despicable. Neither, as I've said, would it have been surprising to most 19th century tourists that Native peoples would be discussed in this way. Few tourists would have expected to find a land acknowledgement in their guidebooks, at least not one that highlighted in positive terms the continuing presence of indigenous peoples in the West, or their rightfully positive place in national consciousness overall by virtue of a supposedly intimate or indelible relationship with the land. Now, that said, What was surprising to many of these same travelers, and what remains underappreciated today, I think, is the degree to which all of these same things were said about so-called Mormons in 19th century railroad guidebooks. Travelers did find land acknowledgments of a sort for Mormons and Mormon culture in their guidebooks. So these were statements asserting that these were Mormons' traditional homelands, that Mormon culture had an intimate and indelible relationship to them, and moreover, that Mormons might well be accepted into the nation on the grounds of that relationship. So that's a story that I'd like to trace in part today. I wish to tell a story about how railroad guidebooks and the greater tourism industry of which they were a part, how they told stories about Utah landforms that simultaneously overlooked indigenous populations and yet also naturalized Mormon presence in Utah in very particular ways. By my reading, tourism guides presented Mormonism as especially indigenous to Utah and simultaneously as a colonial resource for the nation as a whole. Now, railroad agents had certain reasons for representing Mormonism in this way, of course, as we shall see, but such discourse was also of mutual interest to some saints as well, who simultaneously sourced and capitalized on its terms. So thus, this is a story of promotional codependence in the West, and of railroad tourism as an industry of cultural displacement for some, and yet also of religious placement and representation for others. Indeed, it's a story of railroad building as both a Mormon enterprise and a Mormon-making enterprise. It is a story that is not only of how railroads affected Mormonism, affected here being spelled with an A, but also how railroading affected Mormonism, how it created and authorized a certain Mormonism in a certain place, both in fact and certainly in the public imagination. Now, no doubt you'll hear many accounts of how transcontinental connections shaped Mormon practices and sensibilities over the next few days, and I'm really excited to learn more from those conversations myself. So to sort of kick off what I hope will be a continuing conversation, I'd like to nominate as a place to begin the following exchange from 1888. Now, in that year, Charles Francis Adams Jr., then president of the Union Pacific Railroad, Adams wrote to Edwards Roberts, a professional travel writer, regarding Roberts' forthcoming guidebook. Adams was slated to write a preface for Roberts' book, and he planned to sell it along his line and to promote travel on the Union Pacific and along its branches. Now, after receiving an advance copy of the text, however, Adams expressed concerns about Roberts' depictions of Utah and Mormonism in particular. He advised Roberts to omit all critical and derogatory passages, for, he said, among our customers are the Mormons. A book brought out under the auspices of the Union Pacific should, therefore, in my opinion, contain nothing which is offensive to the Mormons. No good tradesman has a right to offend any customer, no matter what his opinions may be, provided he is civil and pays his bills. Now, to us, the Mormons have always been civil, and they have always paid their bills. So the resultant text spoke not of barbarism, in quotes, in Salt Lake City, nor of the treasonable and seditious leadership of LDS church authorities. Those terms, those descriptions had appeared in Roberts' first draft, but Adams made him cut them, while adding also a notion of caution to his readers. You shouldn't believe the things that you read in anti-Mormon literature, he said. Instead, significantly, also by Adams' request, Roberts instructed readers to pay close attention to geography and environment in the Mormon Great Basin and to imagine their relationship to Utah culture and religion. This is important. Indeed, I don't think it's too much to say that such instructions, when coupled by railroad lobbyists' complimentary work among national politicians and newspapermen, such instructions mainlined Utah tourism and Mormonism alike in American minds and markets. Railroads created a particularly observant public for Mormonism and for Mormon lands in the West. So I'll get back to this line of inquiry in a moment. First, I want to highlight just how surprising this corporate friendship between Mormons and railroad officials was to many onlookers at the time. Indeed, if we're to return to those same public celebrations of the Transcontinental Railroad's charter archives in which, as I've already indicated, we often find predictions of Indian demise and displacement in the West, if we return to those same discussions, we would find similar predictions made about Mormonism there. Quote, "The first whistle of the locomotive in the Salt Lake Valley will sound the death knell of Mormonism," announced one observer in 1868. In a typical instance of what I've come to call the death knell thesis. Now, the death knell thesis predicted that trains and capitalism, by opening the West to free enterprise and liberal thought, that it would modernize Utah and it would destroy Mormondom by weakening the institutional power of the church. Now, this did not happen. And even though we here are no longer surprised by this fact, it does seem to me that historians generally have failed to fully account for the degree to which precisely the opposite happened. Rather than sounding its death knell, that is, railroads, their lines, their promotions, their technologies of imagination, railroads in fact gave Mormonism new life, at least along certain lines it did. And so to sort of get a better handle on these things, I suggest that we might usefully return to the Adams-Roberts interaction mentioned before with a few questions in mind. First, why would railroad officials stand up for Latter-day Saints? Why then? Why then in the late 1880s? Why there in the realm of guidebook publications? And finally, why thus? Why in that way? Why by prescribing geographical attention as a remedy or a counterbalance for hostility elsewhere? Now, the first question is the easiest one to sketch out an answer for, even though it is itself complex. Whence the corporate friendship between railroad companies and Mormon institutions? Now, that answer begins most obviously in the 1860s, as you know, when Brigham Young was one of the major contractors for work on the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific Railroads in Utah. He subcontracted grading jobs to area bishops, and he called congregants to labor along the lines. In short order, the Union Pacific especially recognized deep debts to the saints, not only because of their labor, but also because Young donated lands to establish the company hub at Ogden. Now, their relationship only deepened from there, in any case, after the Union Pacific agreed to pay off some of its debts in building materials and rolling stock, which Brigham Young then used to build a branch line from Salt Lake to Ogden, which the Union Pacific then came to rely upon for feeder line traffic and proceeds. By the time of Charles Francis Adams Jr.'s and Edwards Roberts' communication in the 1880s, the Union Pacific had invested in a number of other Mormon-built branch lines as well. The relationship was not always conflict-free, but these institutions, the railroads and the church, recognized a certain institutional codependence nonetheless, and thus also a corporate friendship. Okay, so that sort of too brief history brings us up to the 1880s, which answers in part the question of why then? Why then did Adams defend Mormons? Well, he was deeply invested in Mormon railroading projects by then. But there's another answer to this question as well. Namely that this was an era of new and intense anti-Mormon legislation. The Edmunds-Tucker Act, which passed in 1887, the year before Adams and Roberts' correspondence. The Edmonds-Tucker Act increased punishments for polygamy, permitted seizure of church properties, and did many other things besides, as you know. An accompanying raid then sent some church leaders underground and others to jail, and many persons and properties were returned, again, only after the Woodruff Manifesto in 1890. Railroad agents were seldom public proponents of polygamy, true. But neither did they support Edmonds Tucker or the raid. The Mormons were their friends, remember, but more crassly speaking, too, railroads feared capitalists' disinclination to invest in Utah industry during a period of political turmoil, along with any possible disruption to feeder line traffic. For these reasons, in fact, railroad lobbyists had really tried hard to scuttle the Edmonds-Tucker Act in the first place. For his part, Adams impressed directly upon congressmen that while he had no interest, he said, in interfering in, quote, the moral and criminal side of the situation in Utah, he wished not to disrupt the material side, in his word, by unduly unsettling Mormon businessmen and politicians and public works. Stay the hand of government, he pleaded, at least when it came to the material side of Utah industry and Mormon property holding. Now, of course, the Edmonds-Tucker Act did pass, notwithstanding all railroad lobbying against it. But the 1880s were far from a total loss for the railroad lobby or for the LDS Church, for that matter. And neither did the passage of the Edmonds-Tucker Act jeopardize their friendship. Quite the contrary. In addition to their mutual commitment to protect a material side of Mormon life otherwise threatened by Congress, more on this in a moment, in addition to this, Edmonds-era negotiations opened up important lines of inquiry between church and railroad officials respecting the requirements for Utah statehood. Now, that latter history has been really well documented by Edward Leo Lyman, whose study of the Mormon quest for statehood shows how Central Pacific lobbyists worked to broker relationships between Mormons and the Republican Party while also working with newspapers to soften their anti-Mormon rhetoric until all agreed publicly that only polygamy stood substantially in the way of statehood. Now, this was no small matter in itself, of course, but Lyman is right when he writes, in his words, that such efforts to influence positive press treatments of the Mormons were at least impressive in extent and probably a necessary prerequisite to the attainment of the ultimate goal of Utah statehood, end quote. Now, Lyman's analysis is excellent, and I disagree only with his calling railroad officials an unlikely lobby for Mormonism. Railroad officials were a very likely lobby indeed. And what's more, their work extended well beyond Washington hallways and traditional press outlets. Railroad agents worked across aisles and across genres in Utah and in Washington, in transcontinental guidebooks, as well as in national newspapers, to mainline Mormonism in American politics and popular culture. And thus we come back to the moment and the terms of Adams's and Roberts's correspondence in 1888, the year after Adams and company failed to thwart the Edmonds-Tucker Act. For we see there that railroad agents were successful with the likes of travel guide authors like Edwards Roberts, if not with Congress. They were successful there in maintaining a certain tone relative to both the material side and the moral side of Mormondom. As railroad lobbyists worked to achieve Mormons' political autonomy in Utah, that is, railroad writers worked differently to secure Utah lands for Mormonism and for acts of Mormon religious observation. Okay, so all of this information should help to explain Adams's instructions to Roberts. Moreover, all of this language about, in Adams's words, focusing on the material side of Mormondom and thereby, in my words, securing Utah lands for Mormonism and for acts of Mormon religious observation. All of this should give a sense, too, of the rationale behind Adams's mandate to material and geographical focus in Roberts's guidebook. But there's a bit more to be said along these lines, if you'll bear with me, about how and where that played out in practice. Now, I've read hundreds of travel and tourism guides for Utah, along with countless other depictions of Mormon life from this time. And it's quite clear to me that railroad officials consistently tried to tread a middle route between anti-Mormon and pro-Mormon interests when promoting travel in the Great Basin throughout the 1870s and 1880s. Positioning itself somewhere between alarmist exposés of Mormonism and LDS apologetics, that is, most Utah literature tried to keep alive a rhetoric of curiosity and distinctiveness about Utah while taking care not to scare away any Gentile travelers. The maximizing of passenger traffic in Utah necessitated that its religious curiosities be rendered distinctly visible and visitable, they thought. Religions, at least unusual religions, in other words, needed to be made objects of touristic visitation, and tourists need to be enticed by the opportunities to debate and discover the stuff of religion in situ, on site. Now, sometimes that kind of situational work involved the wholesale fabrication of supposed Mormon sacred sites. Other times, it entailed strategic nods to critiques or concerns at specific places. And still others, it entailed redirecting travelers' attention to different sites and perhaps teaming up with Mormon hosts to tell new stories there. So I'd like to offer an example of each. First, an example of invention. Now, one of the first Utah places in which the Union Pacific Railroad took interest and around which it built particular narratives about Mormonism is Pulpit Rock, here at the head of Echo Canyon along the Transcontinental Railroad. This is how Transcontinental Railroads introduced Pulpit Rock to a traveling public, starting in 1869. Pulpit Rock is on our right hand, they said, in a step-by-step narration of important things to be seen from the train. Pulpit Rock is on our right hand, and Brigham Young preached from it his first sermon in Utah. Addressed to the pioneers, then on their way to Salt Lake City in 1847. This is where Brigham Young stopped, they said, and inspired by an environment that was simultaneously sublime and yet severe, this is where he decided, this is almost our place, we are almost to our right home. It is so close, said the guidebooks, with excitement, we can almost touch it. Now, of course, this entire experience was fabricated by the railroads completely. There's no evidence that Brigham Young or any other Mormon emigrants ever stopped there during their overland treks. It was just a rock, and it just happened to be there along the railroad route into Utah. And that was just good enough for a story. It was like a sort of like for Gentiles version of the This Is the Place proclamation at Immigration Canyon, which was itself a good 2 days walk from the railroad line. The Pulpit Rock was a story, but not just any story. This was a story about the nature of Mormon pasts and about Mormons' supposed connections to their land. Moreover, Pulpit Rock was one of the key sites around which railroads claimed Middle Eastern likenesses for both Mormons and their lands. For when describing Mormons' supposed experiences there, many guidebook authors reached for a quote by Richard Francis Burton, who, when nearing Salt Lake Valley himself in 1860, had written that the pilgrim emigrants, like the Hajis of Mecca and Jerusalem, give vent there to the emotions long pent up within their bosoms by sobs and tears, laughter and congratulations, psalms and hysterics. It is indeed no wonder that the ignorant should fondly believe that the Spirit of God pervades this very atmosphere, and that Zion on the top of the mountains is nearer heaven than other parts of the earth. Now, a few train-era guides reproduce this passage in its entirety when describing Pulpit Rock or its surroundings. Others altered it slightly. But in any case, railroads asked travelers to visualize themselves coming off the plains, awed by the canyons, inspired by the vistas. They created a kind of ethnographic role play for tourists, asking them to picture themselves in a historical scenario that was largely fabricated for the occasion. Moreover, too, and in any case as well, guidebooks retained Burton's notion of graphic and geographic similarity between Mormonism, Islam, and Judaism, for they considered such to be a good inducement to Utah travel. And thus it was that through word and image, and in short order also maps, railroad publicity departments pushed cultural geographical comparisons between Utah and the Holy Land far more than the LDS Church itself did at the time, mind you. They pushed this geographical comparison in order to entice commercial travelers to Utah on a kind of domestic counterpart to Middle Eastern pilgrimage. These, friends, are just a couple of the visual cues by which railroad companies fostered among travelers a sense of Mormonism as a particularly placed religion. The implication of railroad-sponsored tourism literature was clear even before they guided you into the city of the saints proper. Mormons were who they were because of where they were. According to these guidebooks. According to these guidebooks, Mormonism happened within a geography. It imagined a geography, and it could be understood in terms of that geography. It was still a matter of open inquiry, they said, quote, whether Mormonism be a religion or not, end quote, as one book declared to its readers. But the railroads, by their own accounts, they would tell people where to find it, they would help them get there to see it, and they would give them the platforms and the itineraries and the opportunities and the pictures and the maps and the words by which to get there and decide for themselves. If and when travelers reached Salt Lake City, then, they were guided through Mormons' built environment as well. Here again, tourists looked for an expression or for expressions of a religiosity already associated with geography, and railroad officials continued to structure and mediate their expectations. Now, I had written a too lengthy section here about representations of the temple block in the Edmunds Tucker era and how Mormon hosts mobilized to meet and to shape the gaze of the tourists who gathered there, coming off of their experiences at Echo Canyon. But I'll leapfrog that section now in the interest of time, saying only this. That one of the things I was kind of most excited to discover when doing research for my book is that Heber J. Grant ran a livery company in Salt Lake City, which he chartered in 1888 with seed money from the First Presidency. The express purpose of this tour guide company was to meet tourists at Salt Lake City railway stations and by escorting them to certain downtown sites, including the Tabernacle and here Brigham Young's grave, to manage accompanying narratives there. Now, surely the Grant Brothers Livery Company was an important part of the Utah tourism industry. But it links up with the present storyline in even more direct ways, too. For the Grant brothers struck a direct deal with Adams's Union Pacific, the terms of which guaranteed them preferential access to those Gentile tourists at those downtown stations. Now, this too was in 1888, the same year of our Adams-Roberts correspondence. And thus Adams, who was at that time making Roberts cut an entire section featuring a critical reading of tabernacle services and endowment house practices, all cut. Adams made sure, by contracting simultaneously with Grant, that the gaps created by such guidebook omissions could then be filled by Mormon voices themselves on site. And not just any Mormon voices, mind you, but the voices of Heber J. Grant and his brothers and his associates. I thought that was fascinating, but then again, I'm a nerd. In any case, be we nerds or not, we see here that Grant, a man famous later for what has been called the Grant synthesis between collectivist and capitalist endeavors, we see here that Grant was himself sort of cutting his teeth in the tourism business, precisely the venue in which Mormons were trained, as it were, early to seek a certain balance between openness and enclosure, capitalism and communalism, sales and concessions in the public eye and the railroad era. We see also that Grant, who was at that time moving to protect other Mormon properties from Edmunds Tucker Act seizure by different means, for instance, through stock sales and shifts in official ownership. We see here that Grant may have perceived, probably rightly, that the fate of Temple Block was better tried in courts of touristic interest in continuing collaboration with the Union Pacific. For can we not picture Grant or his brothers standing at Brigham Young's grave with tourists themselves holding Roberts' new guidebook, while Grant and Roberts together invited them to consider whether national concerns about Mormon autocracy and secrecy and the like were really just matters of the past, dead and buried with Brigham Young, and thus, whether modern-day saints deserve to keep and to keep building the structures that they saw below them from that hill. I, for one, have pictured this, and notably, some of the tourists who I've been able to trace to these tours decided, yes, saints should keep them. And they wrote as much both in their journals and in more public venues. This was an impactful tour for many, and it was an impactful industry for all. Now, I'd like to tell one last story about the impact of tourism on Mormon imagination and about the constraints as well as the possibilities attendant to it. Like the Pulpit Rock and Temple Block stories before it, this is a tale about guidebooks asking tourists, how and where did Mormonism rightly reside in Utah? But this story shows how, even if railroad officials kept strategic silence at certain spaces while contracting with locals to offer on-site explanations, this story shows how, while that was the case, guidebooks were also more heavy-handed when it came to describing different downtown landmarks and when articulating their religious importance. So, consider the canals, which is a statement that feels funny to say, kind of like David Foster Wallace's instruction to consider the lobster, if you read that. But seriously, consider the canals, for railroad guidebooks most certainly did, and they made really sure that all tourists did, too. Indeed, it was in consideration of canals that guidebooks most obviously picked up the interpretive lines that were sketched out at Pulpit Rock and in the Promised Land map. All outside of the Wasatch Mountains and Pulpit Rock, That is, railroad guidebooks were most invested in mapping correspondences between Utah topographies and Mormon religious expressions along Mormon waterworks and irrigation systems. By guidebooks accounting, Utah canals were special sites of correspondence between the natural and built environments of Mormonism. And as such, they were clear avenues for religious reflection and memory. Now, Roberts had a lot to say about all of this according to Adams's instructions, but another contemporaneous guidebook is perhaps most typical in terms and order of reporting. It pointed tourists to the turtle-roofed tabernacle. Again, note that the focus was largely external in these guides, leaving space for Mormon-generated content on site. It pointed tourists to the tabernacle, and then it ruminated at length, great length, on the grounds around it. The gutters, or rather the ditches, carry streams of pure, clear mountain water, which serves to irrigate the gardens, lawns, and enclosures. And to these trenches is due the luxuriant growth of the flowers, the trees, flowers, plants, and bushes, which give Salt Lake City the appearance of one vast park and flower garden. There is, as a result, an oriental air about the city, which carries one back to the banks of the biblical Jordan and is unlike that of any other city in the Union. Observations of canals led to appreciations of public decorum and evocations of biblical topography. By guidebook's accounts, then, whereas Pulpit Rock may have evoked sentiments reminiscent of, quote, the Hajis of Mecca or Jerusalem, then Salt Lake waterways likened Mormon's promised land unto Jerusalem in the more staid and pastoral key of the Hebrew Bible. Mountain passes and man-made rivers thus complemented each other by this accounting, insofar as they witnessed to Mormons behaving variously like Muslims and Jews. But you'll note also that both Pulpit Rock and Salt Lake canals evoked the sense of geographical determinism in Mormon life by this accounting, but also that, by this account, irrigation canals, in particular, showed Mormons' abilities to reshape the same nature that had supposedly shaped them, too. Now, the guidebooks went on. Ignoring the prevalence of Mormon irrigation practices, as well as the fecundity of some Utah soils, tourism promoters reported matter-of-factly that Mormons had invented irrigation, even as they had naturally hybridized older social patterns complementary to the task. Close-knit villages, communally oriented trade, and even large families, for instance. Mormons were first and foremost an agricultural people, according to this refrain. They were industrious, but not industrialized. Thus, guidebooks made canals into sort of metonyms for Mormonism itself. Each was a cultural product of a peculiar environment, they said, each sustaining seemingly religious and arguably non-industrial phenomena. Okay, there are a couple things for us to say here, beyond noting the sort of irony of an entire industry that is mobilized to promote a picture of pastoralism. The first is that they were not wrong when describing the importance of irrigation to Utah life or when hinting at its relation to LDS systems of trusteeship and the like. And these were indeed helpful and appropriate things for Americans at large to hear, softening as they did certain biased perceptions about the substance of Mormon communal concern and also paving the way for national appreciation of Mormon farming methods as valuable to Western settlement. That said, neither were they innocent or absent of politics in their presentation. To the contrary, arguments about things deemed valuable to Western settlement were seldom innocent at this time. And so here it is where I'd like to point you back to the sort of darker implications of railroads' promotion of Mormons as being the inventors of modern irrigation in an environment that was said to be naturally theirs. Four, it was around irrigation canals that railroad guidebooks pivoted finally to a mention of Native peoples in the Great Basin. And they did so only briefly then, too, only so long as it took to compare what they cast as Mormons' righteous survival in the railroad age to what they cast as Indians' natural demise. This is truly hard stuff to read, but here it is. Here it is that we see that if railroad publications endeavored to naturalize Saint's presence in Utah through suggestions of geographical determinism as well as geographical conquest in Mormon life, they did so often with contrast or through contrast to what they described as the American Indian experience. For here it was that guidebooks like Roberts's claimed that, whereas Mormons and Indians might both be imagined as having sort of pre-modern or ecstatic experiences in Utah and places like Pulpit Rock or the Witch's Rocks nearby, only Mormons, they said, escaped being fully entrapped and entombed by them. Robert said all of this, by the way, while pointing to a supposed tomb near the Great Salt Lake that housed, he said, the last members of an ancient Utah tribe. So Adams and Roberts, what they called their worldly gospel about Utah, that worldly gospel thus amounted to the claim that Mormons, unlike Indians, managed to dominate and domesticate the same geography that also constrained and constructed them, especially through their irrigation systems. Moreover, Mormons, unlike Indians, were said to have made and to have made available particularly tangible materials by which to theorize different modes of religious expression, as at Pulpit Rock and Temple Block, and to reconsider the materiality of religion itself from train stations to tabernacle seats. Thus, railroads helped Americans to see Mormons themselves as a colonial resource, one whose supposed capacity to displace natives and anchor modern religious concerns was equally, if not more valuable, than any of Utah's mineral deposits might have been. Here we see how railroad promoters aligned Mormons with the same colonial projects that Mormons were also made subject to in other ways. Put differently, here we see how railroads, when defending Mormons from the type of destruction predicted by the anti-Mormons' death knell thesis, here we see how railroads defended Mormons partly by casting them as amenable to the anti-Indian ambitions of that same biased and basic group. Now, I wish I could say that Mormons were only cast thus, and that Mormons did not also sometimes align themselves with some of the same colonial projects to which they were made simultaneously subject. But that would be too simple and too wishful a statement. For the fact is that Mormons sometimes did mobilize to meet tourists' gaze in ways that indeed met it rather than challenged it. And one need only look to the Deseret Museum, which John W. Young designed specifically as a tourist attraction, to see how that played out. One might also look to the Utah Exposition Palace Car, which the Union Pacific lent to the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce in 1888, in order to take their collaborative Mormon defenses on the road. But I'll go with the Deseret Museum for now. For the museum's 1870s and 1880s celebrations of Utah life said little to nothing about contemporaneous indigenous populations or practices, preferring instead to cast Mormons' Western legitimacy and national value in contrast to them. Tragically. So transcontinental tourists would have looked often in vain for representations or discussions of Washakie at the Deseret Museum, therefore, for instance. let alone other communities less intimately connected with the saints. Of course, it's sometimes uncertain whether certain tourists would have even known to look for such representations in the first place, given guidebook's silence on this subject. But then again, perhaps they would have. For the fact was that Native peoples were all over Utah, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear. Where were they? Well, they were riding trains. They were trading at train stations. They were gathering seasonally outside Corinne. They were on reservations in the north and the south and the east of Salt Lake. And they were in many other places, spaces between them. Indeed, some indigenous groups were trying to set up tourist displays of their own around then, too. For instance, when a group of Northwestern Shoshone hosted a powwow, advertising it as a free event for visitors and tourists, and then smartly demanding from them an exit fee when it was done. But save perhaps for the photographic work of C.R. Savage, whose Indian portraits did sometimes appeal to tourists and garner national attention, much of this activity seemed as if a public secret, if we were to believe most publicity work and popular representation, and indeed the authorized displays of the Deseret Museum or the Union Pacific Railroad. Again, anyone with eyes to see could have seen that their collective silence on that front was a lie, but neither did many powerful people then do much to belie it. Okay, so this may well be the time to disclose the title of the book that we've been talking about for much of the last 40 minutes. Edwards Roberts's Union Pacific sanctioned guidebook was titled Shoshone and Other Western Wonders. But as we've seen, there were very few Shoshone in it. Granted, Robert's title here referenced Shoshone Falls, which the Union Pacific was hoping to promote as a tourist attraction. But still, there was little to no discussion about the actual Shoshones who lived in its vicinity or visited it themselves or after whom it was named. Railroads were much more invested in making Mormons a Western wonder at that time than they were the Shoshone, or any other group for that matter. Indeed, one need only track with their land acknowledgments, or their lack thereof, to see as much. One need only track with the ways in which railroad promoters invented or amplified notions of cultural significance in some places, while overriding or rendering merely nominal others elsewhere, to see what their corporate priorities were, and with whom they felt a sense of corporate collegiality at any given time. Now, I'll state again that it was by no means a foregone conclusion that Latter-day Saints would have been counted among railroad's closest friends and best customers, either in the 1860s or the 1880s or beyond. Such friendship marked an ironic turn against the ubiquitous terms and the powerful proponents of the death knell thesis. And while we as historians may debate the degree to which the industries of such irony affected or effected Mormonism in positive or negative ways, and I look forward to hearing many such debates along those lines in the next couple of days, while we may debate that, I think it is beyond question that tourism and railroads were powerfully productive forces in and for Mormon history and for the statehood of certain Utah religions, notwithstanding many predictions to the contrary. In 1869, 150 years ago this year, anti-Mormons predicted that railroad connections would destroy Mormonism. Little did they know that, over the next 25 years, LDS officials and businessmen would flip their secular script entirely, repeatedly finding ways either to bend railroads to their benefit or to reshape Mormon institutions themselves in order to flourish in their increasingly networked world. Meanwhile, robber barons, That was a slip of the tongue. Railroad barons. Meanwhile, railroad barons, seeking favorable contract and uninterrupted freighting, not to mention also the lucrative receipts of transcontinental tourism, they cultivated friendships with Mormon businessmen in Utah, intervened on their behalf in Congress, and worked elsewhere to ensure the commensurability of their bureaucratic and social interests. Of course, some such interventions on behalf of Mormon stability seem the stuff entirely of cold calculation about a basic bottom line, the desire to make money. And sometimes it feels like railroad companies' focus on the geography of Mormonism was intended much more as a mode of containment and restriction than of national mobility. But then again, there are moments when railroad officials seem genuinely to have cared about Mormon people and practices in the Great Basin, and when they wanted, above all, to exert a humanizing influence over an erstwhile dismissive at best and demonizing at worst popular gaze, to provide a space, that is, for real human respite and real religious freedom in Utah. The result of their overlapping efforts was, in any case, the combined naturalizing in Utah and mainlining in America of Mormonism, as tourists especially were convinced that Mormons were a spectacularly geographical people from whom they might learn to conquer and cultivate Western lands, and that they evoked safely an Oriental otherness around which Americans might then learn to locate and define religion themselves in the modern West. By the 1890s, Mormonism's status was secure. It was a religion of and for the railroad era. Thank you.